Okay, a little bit of background about this talk. The talk was prompted by a lot of discussion within a project called the Palette Project, about the meaning of the idea of communities of practice. It's central to the project, and yet there were wide variations in people's understanding of it. So this talk really is just a contribution to developing our thinking on the notion of communities of practice, which are at the heart of the project. Now, I've had a long-standing interest in this topic because my research area is in the relationship between education and work. And I've noted the development of narratives in theory about how education, learning, and work connect over the last, say, 20 or 30 years. And the idea of learning actually being produced through practices is a relatively new idea, perhaps developing over the last 15 years or so. So I have a particular interest in this area, hence the request that I made a contribution of this kind to the summer school. Now, what I want to do is talk a little bit about different conceptions of the notion of communities of practice and how those differ. And how the dominant notion actually has quite a few little problems with it, and then try and bring it all together at the end in an integrated or unified way. So, I want to put forward this kind of proposition that, first of all, people learn at work through their engagement in practices. So, it's not so much going off on a weekend school to a posh hotel. To eat and drink, although that is a very pleasant activity, a lot more learning goes on through core practices associated with the workplace. You can understand a workplace in lots of different ways. You can think of it as an organisation. You can think of it in terms of individuals doing things. But the approach that I think is most useful is to see the workplace as a social environment of some kind, and there are various ways of understanding that. And the notion of community of practice adopts that perspective that the workplace is essentially a social environment of some kind. And there are other ways of looking at it, for example, Engstrom's notion of an activity system. But the important thing is that it's actions within a social environment, not individual actions, but actions produced and developing through people interacting. At the same time, as people are interacting within a workplace through communities of practice, knowledge is both accessed, used, developed, circulating, and evolving. So, the position taken up in the talk is that the development of knowledge is an extremely fluid, continually evolving, moving object. It's not something which is static. So it's quite an important notion that the way knowledge emerges in this situation is quite complicated, or at least complex anyway, lots of different layers and so on. And the final point, just sort of by way of introduction to this, is that learning processes within workplaces are in the area of informal or non-formal learning. And that's the emphasis I want to make. And it's not saying that other types of learning don't take place because, of course, we all know there's formal training and stuff like that. But essentially, we're emphasizing the informal or non-formal learning processes that go on within a working environment characterized by a community of practice. Now, obviously, the main contributor, or the most well-known contributor to this area of thinking, certainly over the last 15 years or so, has been Wenger. And in our project, the Palette Project, Wenger's notion of a community of practice is one that is prominent. But when you look at Wenger's work, it's actually quite difficult to pin the idea down. Now, I've got a quote that I use in my head, in which Wenger tries to capture the essence of practice. And when you read it, you think you know what it is, but then you find it's slipped away. And what he does is use a whole series of descriptors, but never actually defines the core element within the concept of practice. I'll give you a couple of ideas about this. I mean, he knows, for example, that practices include both the explicit and the tacit. In other words, it's something which is both written down transparent, talked about on the one hand, and not talked about, unacknowledged, tacit, and quite often ill-formed. A couple of other things. He says it includes both the unsaid and the said. He says it includes tools, documents, images, and symbols. He says it includes all the implicit relations, tacit conventions, subtle cues. In other words, what he says is a social situation is a social situation. So he has a sense of being rather engaging in truism here. So we're not that far on in knowing exactly what a practice is after we read Wenger. Another development of the idea of Wenger is, and this is, I think, extremely useful, is that he sees practice not as a single event or a piece of isolated behaviour, like somebody jumping out of a window or hitting somebody or kicking over a table in frustration or something like that. That's not the sort of practice he's talking about. So practice is not the same as a piece of behaviour or a specific event. He wants to stress the notion of its historical condition. In other words, we arrive at this piece of practice because it's developed over time. That's one important thing. And the other thing is that it's not individual. Practice, by definition for Wenger, is always social. So it's the combination, in my terms anyway, between the sort of social context in which practice develops. But of course, it involves biography, historical circumstances, and even personality. But Wenger tends to completely de-emphasize the notion of personality. In other words, the psychological is not, in a traditional sense, is not his concern. So, in my view, in looking at Wenger, we really do need a slightly tighter concept, a core concept of practice that we can say in a matter of two or three sentences, which capture the essence of the notion of practice. Because, of course, the community of practice is absolutely crucial that we have a real tight, understandable and transparent definition of practice. And when you read Wenger's work, it's actually quite difficult to do it. There are all kinds of things it includes, but we don't have a sense of its core characteristics. So we need to look elsewhere. Now, one place to look is in classic sociological theory, modern classic sociological theory of Giddens, Anthony Giddens, who, writing in the 70s and 80s, so we're talking 20 or 30, 25 years or so of development of this idea, was trying to identify exactly what the characteristics of a practice may be. So we need to consider this. Now, the first thing is there are lots of commonalities, but it's tighter. The concept is tighter. First of all, it does refer to behaviour. So at the heart of practice is behaviour. But it's not necessarily active behaviour like banging a nail in a piece of wood. It could be behaviour associated with interpreting a poem or interpreting a picture or a painting, watching a play. So it's behaviour in its broadest sense. But the first point is it is behaviour. Second point that Giddens makes is that it's recurrent or routine. It's something that happens day to day over time. So it's not a one-off, it's something that we can say, ah, yes, that's the way he or she does things. And you can't say that if it's just a one-off piece of behaviour. So it's action, it's recurrent, and it's routine, and it's rooted in daily practice. So if you're talking about the workplace, then it's stuff that goes on every single day. And the third point is that it's reproduced in a social context. And this is where he agrees with Wenger. You can't really logically have individual action which isn't social in this sort of framework. It's by definition arrived at through the individual's interactions with others in a social situation. Now, the fourth part of the definition is that it is governed by rules. Now, rules is a tricky word in English, and I'm sure translated into other European languages. We need to kind of interpret what rules means. Now, one way of interpreting it is that it's the knowledge base on which people draw to do something. So it's in its broadest sense, it amounts to a series of knowledge resources. How do we know we ought to do X? Then you are actually drawing on a knowledge base to be able to make that sort of decision. Of course, quite often we don't make the decision because it's implicit or tacit, so we just do it because we've been socialized into a particular environment. But the point is, though, that the definition involves the following maxim. A practice is routine, recurrent, rule-governed behavior. So it's a nice, tight definition of practice in one sentence. Now, of course, underlying that tight, single definition is quite a complex analysis. Important bits are routine, rule-governed. Those are the important bits for me. Right. There's another important concept in the whole domain of communities of practice that we derive from Wenger's work, and that is the notion of reification. Now, quite a lot of the time, our practices, which are routine and rule-governed, to use Giddens's phrase, become what he calls, Wenger that is, reified. In other words, they become congealed, held together, captured in some way. Quite often, it's the simplest way of understanding reification is when informal practices become captured in some sort of procedure, set of procedures. So part one of a procedure, two procedures, three, and so on. First of all, you put your name tag on, then you sit down, and then you welcome the guest, and so on. It's those sorts of things which have been captured as a practice in the form of a written procedure. And at its simplest form, a reification involves writing something down. So it's physically available on a piece of paper in the form of a text. So, important concept in communities of practice is how you capture practice in such a way that it can be made available and become stabilized and held in time. And that's where the metaphor of congealed comes from. It becomes a thing. It's a very, very interesting idea. Okay. There are, however, other important concepts associated with the knowledge resources people might draw upon in a community of practice, which Wenger doesn't really go into in too much detail. It's there in his work, but it's scattered. He's a very verbose writer. Lots and lots of detail. Now, I like the concept of a knowledge form, which Frank Blackler here at Lancaster University developed. He didn't actually develop the original idea, but in a review, very important review article written in 1995, he tried to discuss the different knowledge forms that we draw upon in our day-to-day practices. Now, he didn't actually say they were drawn upon in day-to-day practices. I'm saying that. Now, when we talk about rules, our behaviours which are rule-governed, and I'm interpreting rules as the knowledge bases or the knowledge resources on which we draw, what exactly are these knowledge bases? What forms do these knowledge resources or knowledge bases take? Well, interestingly, Blackler's work gives us a clue. He says that in a workplace, you've got at least five different types of knowledge resource on which you can draw as you go about your daily routine practices. First of all, there are what he called embrained knowledge resources. These are kind of theories, things in books, stable ideas about what is and is not. It could be technical knowledge, mathematical knowledge, and so on and so forth. But the important point is that it's stable, it's publicly available, it might have been tested over time, and essentially it's kind of cognitive, propositional public knowledge. So that's one resource. So if we're doing, I suppose if you can think of a piece of surgery undertaken by a surgeon, the surgeon is going to rely on embrained knowledge in terms of the nature of the disease, the construction of the human body, etc. What would happen if he sticks the knife in here as opposed to sticking it in there? So those are sort of embrained knowledge. Interestingly, though, he has four other areas, and I've always found these incredibly useful in thinking about practices. The next one is what he calls embodied knowledge, which is that whole range of tacit understanding and the knowledge resource you need just to exist in a social situation. It could be families, friends, work colleagues, and so on. It's whether you use that cup rather than that cup, or sit here rather than sit there, or enter these kinds of conversations in this kind of situation, or you don't. So it's all the sort of informal rules that constitute how work colleagues get along together and even might get things done. Don't talk to Joan. She may be occupying that position. Talk to Tim. He's the one that can actually get things done. And so on. So it's that informal knowledge about the way we do things around here. Then he talks about encultured knowledge, which put simply is the discourse, the language of a particular working environment. Now, every working environment has its own discourse. It can be highly technical, but it could also be based on the myths and legends and incidents in the past which people remember and refer back. You know, don't do a Charlton means that you don't do something that Jim Charlton did 10 years ago, resulting in some catastrophic event. So it's that sort of thing. Every working situation has its own language. The fourth area is what he calls embedded knowledge, which is actually knowledge of the routines and reified practice in Wenger's terms. It's the systems, written down, procedures, rules. A good example in the higher education environment would be the rules concerning plagiarism, or the rules concerning submission of late essays, that sort of thing. Finally, there's an area of knowledge that he discusses called encoded knowledge, which is the form in which communications take place within a social environment, working environment in particular. It might be a face-to-face culture where a lot of talking goes on. It could be a memo culture where things are done at a distance via email. In the old days, it would be via these horrible little notes you'd find in your pigeonhole from the boss. It could be that there's a combination. It could be very informal. It could be rather formal. But it's the form with which communications take place, not the content, but the form in which information circulates in an environment. Now, these knowledge resources are the kinds of, are the sources, if you like, of the rules discussed earlier in Giddens' notions of practice. Now, Blackler also makes some interesting observations about knowledge, what he calls knowledge descriptors. And they're, again, sort of axioms, statements, maxims. First of all, knowledge is mediated. By that, we mean that it's not static, it's evolving, misinterpreted and overinterpreted, collectively interpreted, interactionally interpreted, and so on. So it's a real moving, spongy, plasticky sort of entity. And it's a great mistake to see knowledge as something which is just there forever, captured, stone-like in its form. We also think that knowledge often is much more situated than we hitherto understood. In other words, it's produced and used in circumstances which are quite often very contextualized. Moving out of that context can sometimes render the knowledge either unusable or non-understandable. Not completely. In brain, knowledge, of course, is by definition something which is decontextualized. But a lot of knowledge is situated, and we have to recognize that. We have to recognize that knowledge is provisional. It's not something there forever, and it connects to the notion of mediation. We also have to understand knowledge as being pragmatic. There's a sense in which people use knowledge for highly specific purposes. It's not something which is done, if you like, for its own sake. Usually, knowledge is in an instrumental context. It's for a reason. Not always, because one would read a poem or look at a picture because it's intrinsically an enjoyable thing, or listening to music. But quite often in a workplace, of course, knowledge is pragmatic in the sense it's useful for something else. Finally, knowledge is contested. In other words, one person's truth is not another person's truth. And the big problem with Wenger's work has been that he tends to assume that knowledge from veterans, people who've been involved in a community practice for a long time, is privileged over the knowledge offered by newcomers. Another possible way of understanding learning is to see the way learning contexts take place within particular environments. I'll say this rather quickly because it's not crucial to our understanding of a community of practice. But again, how does a community of practice learn? Well, it tends to be in four main types of context. First of all, there's the informal, immediate learning context in which people just ask for tips. You know, how do you do this? How do you do X? Sometimes learning has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it has this project feel to it. You go somewhere to find something out. It might not necessarily be validated by the form of a communication, a qualification or anything like that. Thirdly, quite often learning is formalized. People go on courses, MAs, master's courses, to validate their learning. And fourthly, quite often learning contexts are highly diffused, much more ill-defined, changing. And I think the new technologies have enabled these learning needs, which are born out of very strong common values, quite often globally located, to develop in a way that before they wouldn't. People might come together for a conference every 2 years or something. Now, of course, they can communicate on a daily basis and explore the areas that they're interested in. So we have immediate learning context, we have project learning context, we have valid or validated learning contexts, and we have more organic learning contexts. I mentioned earlier the notion of informal or non-formal learning as another way of characterising the learning that goes on in a community of practice. And the work of Michael Errow and others in the UK have explored this notion. It's a very liberating notion, and it recognises that probably about 80% of our learning actually takes place in the non-formal or the informal environments in which we work and live. That's why I find it a very interesting concept. We know it happens everywhere, all the time. It happens, there are no time constraints in when one's learning informally. You don't have to turn up to a special place at a special time to engage in it. There's no prescribed framework. It's rarely organised as in an event or a package. It can use all kinds of resources for learning, all kinds of different types of people and objects can be used as a learning resource. It happens socially naturally and is not usually accredited. By socially naturally, I mean it's embedded and woven into normal interactions. Like, for example, one could imagine at a party when somebody says, I don't know how to download music. Well, come over here, I'll show you 5 minutes. It's very, very easy. Another example we use is my uncle, for example, telling me how to prune roses. Took about 3 minutes on the way to the car after a family party, and I've never forgotten it. But that's the sort of learning process we're talking about. It's usually open-ended, has no specification of learning outcomes and so on, but it may have learning intentions. And finally, we need to distinguish it from the notion of socialization. In other words, there's a small part of deliberation in informal learning. We don't always know it's going on, but we know it's happening. Now, finally, I'd like to draw these ideas together by reference to an overall or integrated approach to learning through work in a community of practice. I want you to imagine a workplace which is constituted by a series of practice clusters. Now, in higher education, for example, practice clusters are practices that focus on a particular area of activity. We could think of, say, assessment procedures as an example. We could say the teaching and learning environments in which we're working. We could say it's the pastoral or the social and personal care of students. It could be practices associated with feedback and so on, practices associated with curriculum design. You know, one could imagine perhaps 8 or 9 clusters of practices associated with our core work as academics. Now, each of those practices within practice clusters refer to a knowledge resource according to this view. So we use embrained, encultured, embodied, embedded knowledge to inform our practice or to shape our practice. So if you imagine work as being a community of practices rather than a community of practice around these practice clusters. Now, new members entering this environment access practice through informal learning processes, normally through interactions with their work colleagues. Now, there is a critique of the straight induction processes that Wenger talks about. We think it might be a lot more uneven and backwards and forwards process of learning. But nevertheless, new entrants are engaged in an enculturation process whereby they gradually become aware of the knowledge resources which characterise a particular community of practice. Now, in becoming aware of these knowledge resources, they not only use them, but of course they create new knowledge resources, new ways of doing things, new rules. They bring their own histories, experience of work from outside into the community of practice and gradually evolve it and transform it. And of course, the community of practice has to negotiate new challenges and so on. So this, again, is not a static environment. But the role of newcomers into this environment is underemphasized by Wenger. Not by Giddens, who doesn't refer to communities of practice at all. But if we adopt a Giddensian view of practice, then it allows us to see how newcomers can completely transform practice clusters within an environment. So taking us through that sort of cycle or circle of learning, newcomers then begin to evolve new processes, new knowledge resources, and we come back to practice clusters which characterize a community of practice. So this process unfolds and evolves over time. So what I've tried to do then is to render some core ideas associated with communities of practice, suggest there are one or two things in Wenger's notion of community of practice which, while incredibly evocative and useful, need some further development. We need a tighter definition of practice, and people like Giddens provides us with that. We need a better idea of the knowledge resources that a community of practice might access in order to think of tools and services for the community of practice. And we need to be very clear about the evolving and unstable nature of the knowledge resources and practices which characterize a community of practice. That's not to say, just last sentence, that the community of practice is completely unstable. It isn't, but it's continually evolving around the edges. Thank you very much.